All right, welcome back to the deep dive. Today we're taking a look at a landmark case in music copyright law.
Okay.
Three Boys Music versus Bolton. This one actually comes from a listener request
Oh, great
who
comment.
sent this in. A really fascinating case and a really great way to unpack some of the nuances of intellectual property,
Yeah.
especially as they relate to music and
For
creation.
sure, for sure. This case really goes to show, I think, some of the complexities when you're talking about music and copyright infringement. And it's a very interesting one because it really highlights this concept of subconscious copying. So we'll get into that.
In this case, I guess the puzzle we want to unpack today is how the Isley brothers were able to win a $5.4 million judgment
I know.
against Michael Bolton for copyright infringement
Right.
without any direct proof that he intentionally copied their song.
Yeah, so that's the central question here is, how is it that you can be liable for copyright infringement when you don't actually intentionally copy a song?
Exactly. And that's why this is so relevant for anyone listening. This case kind of changed the way we view music copyright infringement,
Yes.
really highlighted this concept of subconscious copying, and also shows how complicated it can be to
Right.
prove and determine musical plagiarism.
Yeah.
But crucially, this case showed that you can look at the combination of elements in a piece of music,
Yes.
even if individually those elements aren't copyrightable, to
Absolutely.
make a case for infringement.
Yeah, it's really focusing on the combination of elements and not just the individual elements themselves.
To set the stage, we are talking about two songs,
Okay.
both titled Love is a Wonderful Thing.
Right.
The Isley Brothers released their version in 1964.
Okay.
And then in 1991, Michael Bolton released his version, which was a huge hit.
It was a huge hit, yeah.
And importantly, the Isley Brothers version wasn't like a chart topper,
Right.
but it did receive some radio play,
Yes.
specifically in Connecticut,
Right.
which, as it happens, is where Michael Bolton grew up.
Which is very important. That becomes a key piece of evidence in this case.
So Three Boys Music Corporation, which represents the Isley Brothers, sued Bolton and his co-writer Andrew Goldmark for copyright infringement.
Right.
What was the initial decision in the case?
Well, the jury actually found in favor of the Isley Brothers and awarded them $5.4 million in damages. And then the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals upheld this verdict. So, as we mentioned earlier, there was no clear evidence that Bolton had intentionally copied the song. So how is it that
Barbie.
they were able to win?
How do you even begin to prove infringement when there isn't a smoking gun?
Well, this case really centers on two key elements in proving copyright infringement: access and substantial similarity.
Okay, so let's dig into access first. How did the Isley Brothers prove or
Right.
argue that Bolton would have had access to their song?
Well, so their argument rested on a couple of things. One was that they were able to show that there was radio play of the Isley Brothers song in Connecticut. And this, again, is where Bolton grew up. And they also pointed to the fact that Bolton himself had a history of, performing and enjoying R&B music from that era. So they kind of argued that, taking together these facts create a reasonable possibility that Bolton would have heard the Isley Brothers song at some point.
So it wasn't necessarily about proving without a doubt that he heard it, but that he had a reasonable opportunity to have heard it.
Correct. Exactly. It's really about reasonable opportunity or reasonable possibility.
And so then we move to substantial similarity.
Okay.
How did they convince the jury that these two songs were substantially similar?
Well, this is where it gets a little tricky. Because, as you listen to the two songs, they're not exactly the same.
They're not identical.
No, not at all. However, the court identified five key elements that overlap between the two songs.
What were those?
So they pointed to melody, the structure of the song, lyrical phrasing, certain rhythmic accents, and harmonic patterns.
So, I mean, some of those things like rhythmic accents and harmonic patterns, those are kind of common to lots of different musical genres and songs.
Exactly. And that gets us to this really important concept called the combination doctrine. So the court found that although individual elements might not be copyrightable on their own, the unique combination of these five elements in the two songs was enough to constitute substantial similarity.
So it wasn't that like a particular melody was copied note for note. It was the combination of elements that created a similar feeling.
Exactly. It was the overall effect of the combination of these elements that the court really focused on.
Gotcha. Now, there was also this idea of the inverse ratio rule that played a role in the case. Can you explain what that is?
Sure. So the inverse ratio rule basically says that the stronger the evidence of access, the less compelling the evidence of similarity needs to be.
Interesting.
To prove infringement. So, you know, in this case, the evidence of access wasn't overwhelming, but it was sufficient.
Right.
And so the court essentially said that because there was some evidence of access, the standard for proving substantial similarity was a little bit lower.
Okay.
So, you know, taking together the evidence of access and the evidence of substantial similarity was enough to convince the court.
Interesting. Okay. So Bolton's team also tried to challenge the validity of the Isay Brothers copyright. What was the basis of that argument?
Yeah. So they pointed to some discrepancies between the sheet music that the Isay Brothers had registered with the Copyright Office and the actual recording of the song.
Okay. So there were some slight differences between what was registered and what was released as the song.
Exactly. They did. Yes. They said that you know, there was no evidence that these discrepancies were intentional or fraudulent and that they didn't prejudice Bolton in any way.
So minor errors or inconsistencies are okay?
Basically, yeah, unless there's evidence of fraud or bad faith.
Gotcha. Okay. Now let's talk about the damages. So the jury awarded the Isay Brothers $5.4 million. How did they come up with that number?
Right. So this gets into the idea of profit apportionment.
Okay.
So the jury had to determine what percentage of Bolton's profits from his album Time, Love, and Tenderness were attributable to the infringing song.
Gotcha.
And they decided that 28% of his album profits were due to Love is a Wonderful Thing.
Wow.
And then for sync licensing fees, so this is money that Bolton earned from licensing the song for use in commercials and movies.
Yeah.
They attributed 66% of those fees to the infringing material.
Interesting. Why such a higher percentage for the sync licensing fees?
Well, the thinking was that the elements that were found to be infringing were particularly important for the song's commercial success.
Right.
Especially when it comes to things like commercials and movies.
So it's almost like those catchy elements that were, you know, found to be infringing were the things that made the song appealing for those.
Like the uses.
Yes. Okay. And then there was also a ruling about whether Sony Music could deduct tax liabilities from the damages, right?
Yeah. Right. So Bolton's record label, Sony Music, argued that they should be able to deduct their tax liabilities when calculating the damages, but the court disagreed.
Okay.
And essentially they said that copyright damages are based on gross profits.
Okay.
Not net profits.
So no deducting taxes.
Right.
Gotcha. So even after the initial judgment, Bolton's team filed a motion for a new trial.
Yes, they did.
Citing new evidence.
Right.
What was that about?
So Bolton's team claimed that they had discovered a 1963 contract that raised some questions about the Isay Brothers' ownership of the copyright.
Okay.
However, the court denied the motion for a new trial for a couple of reasons.
Sure.
First of all, the motion was filed 8 months late.
Right.
Which is well beyond the deadline.
Wow.
And the court also said that even if the motion had been timely, this new evidence wouldn't have changed the outcome of the case.
Okay. So, I guess this really emphasizes how important it is to present all of your evidence up front.
Absolutely.
During the trial, because there's not really a second chance.
Generally not, no. You gotta come with your best case from the start.
So what are some of the big takeaways from this case for our listeners?
Well, I think one of the big ones is this concept of subconscious copying.
Yeah.
So, you know, you don't have to set out to intentionally copy someone's work to be liable for copyright infringement.
Right, as long as you had access.
Right, if you have access and the works are substantially similar, even if that similarity is subconscious, you could be in trouble.
Okay, what else?
Well, this case also shows the power of the jury in copyright cases.
Oh.
So, appellate courts often give a lot of deference to jury verdicts, especially on questions of substantial similarity.
And that makes sense because, I mean, music is so subjective.
It is very subjective. It's difficult to come up with hard and fast rules.
It is, yeah.
So, you know, the jury's opinion on whether two works are substantially similar is usually given a lot of weight.
Right. And so then what advice would you give to a musician or someone in the music industry based on this case?
Well, I think one of the big lessons is that you have to be really careful about subconscious copying.
Yeah.
So even if you're not intentionally trying to rip off someone else's song, if you've been exposed to a lot of music in a particular genre, you could unintentionally create something that's too similar.
So like even if you change a few things, if it's still substantially similar, you could get in trouble.
Yeah, and that's especially true if the combination of elements is similar, even if the individual elements themselves aren't that unique.
Right, right. Okay. Anything else to keep in mind?
Well, I think it's also important to remember that copyright law is very fact-specific.
Okay.
So there's no easy formula for determining infringement. Every case is going to depend on the specific details of the works involved and the evidence that's presented.
So it's not as simple as like, oh, I changed this note, therefore it's not copyright infringement.
No, it's much more nuanced than that.
Okay, well, very interesting case. Lots to think about. So to recap our deep dive into Three Boys Music versus Bolton, we talked about how subconscious infringement can have serious legal consequences.
Yes.
We also discussed the roles of access and substantial similarity in proving infringement.
Yes.
And we talked about how important the combination doctrine is.
Yes.
And lastly, we talked about the practical implications of this case for music creation and copyright litigation.
Absolutely.
So as a final thought for you, our listeners, this case really shows that there's a delicate balance between drawing inspiration from existing works and crossing the line into infringement.
Yes.
Even if you're not doing it intentionally.
Right.
So I guess the question for you all is, how does this case change the way you think about originality and intellectual property?
Yeah, it's a really important question to consider. And it also raises some ethical considerations for creators. You know, how do we balance the desire to be inspired by others with the need to create something truly original?
Yeah.
It's a complex issue. And I think this case really highlights the importance of understanding copyright law for anyone involved in the creative process.
Absolutely.
So hopefully this deep dive has given you some food for thought.
Yeah, great case.
Thanks for having me.
And yeah, we'll see you next time on the deep dive.
See you later.
Bye.